Garza for Clark County Office of the Coroner Medical Examiner versus the Las Vegas Review Journal. We have Ms. Nichols and Mr. Eccles representing the appellant, Ms. McClatchy representing the respondent.
And Ms. Sheldon as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Eccles, would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. And kind of the way that we've structured this is I'd like to do 10 minutes on the lead autopsy case. Ms. Nichols will do 10 minutes on her fees case. And then I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal on my case, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal on her case.
Okay. Sounds like a plan. It's a 60-minute argument, so we may do so. Okay. You may proceed, Mr. Eccles.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Micah Eccles for the coroner. The coroner is present in the court today as well. So the first item you have is NRS 432B.407 sub 6. This is the confidentiality of documents, which in the statute says information acquired by and the records of the child death review team. What we have here is a public records request that asks for records from 2012 up through the date of the request, which is in 2017. It was kind of just a very broad request. I believe it was that same day the coroner's office replies and says, hey, we have Attorney General Opinion 82-12, which the Attorney General has counseled government entities that all autopsies are contain so much private and health information that we're not going to disclose those as a matter of policy. There's a lot of email exchange. Eventually on May 26th, same year, 2017, we get the RJ to whittle down 126 cases. And they say, we're interested in these 126 cases. So there were email exchanges, and the coroner even met with the RJ reporters on a Sunday just to try to figure out exactly what it is that we're looking for so we can assist them with the request. So on the fifth day after that, what we've called in our briefs the clarified request, which was May 31st, we said in an email, hey, we're going to need some more time because we have to go look at these individual records and figure out if they're child death review team cases or non-child death review team cases. And so what we came up with, 126 files that the RJ had designated, we said all of these are CDR cases with the exception of 49 files. And what we did is we said, we will give you all the information that we normally give out in autopsies according to the Clark County Code, which is name, day of death, cause and manner of death, etc. And they said, well, we want the redacted information. We want this public information. But we also want the information that goes beyond this public information, the information that we contain, claim is confidential. So what the district court did with this statute, and in our minds, this is just a plain language in sub 6 of the CDR statute. What the district court said in its order is that at some point this has to expire. It's almost like the district court says, I'm going to apply an investigatory privilege to this statute. Once the investigation's over, nothing's confidential anymore. But we have sub 4 of the statute, which refers to NRS 239.0115. And that places a 30-year presumption of confidentiality. And so it's not just the end of an investigation. The district court also said, well, aside from any privilege, which we think is very explicit in sub 6, he said, I'm going to balance this into the Donray test, and I just don't think that you, as a coroner, have presented me with enough of an interest to show that these shouldn't just be released. And so that's the order we have from the district court is all of the 126 autopsy reports are to be disclosed without any redaction.
Mr. Eccles, so your position is that if the record as it was at the coroner's office, autopsy report, subsequently is given to one of these child death review teams, that makes it forever confidential if it wasn't already in the coroner's records? By giving it over to the child death review team, something that wasn't confidential became confidential?
Well, I understand, Your Honor, based on the PERS case, that's
the review journal's argument. But, and I suppose if the court wants to engage in that analysis, it can, which is our first argument, based on the legal underpinnings, public policy that the Attorney General has given, that all autopsies should be confidential. But here we have the specific language of sub 6 of the CDR statute that says information acquired by. That's the difference between this case and the PERS case, because in PERS it didn't have that acquired by.
But wouldn't acquired by necessarily refer to the team itself and not agency representatives of the team individually?
So sub 1 of the CDR statute, sub 1, and then sub B, any autopsy and coroner's investigative records relating to the death. I think that information supports our position that we're talking about everything here on these CDR cases.
No, but the team doesn't have to produce anything. That doesn't. Again, I want to understand why the members of the team individually comprise something other than the team itself.
Okay, so if I understand your question, and you're saying, hey, this records request just came to the coroner, not to the whole team?
No, the statute is indicating that the team doesn't have to produce anything, right? That's
correct.
What the statute says.
Mm-hmm.
And so the team, I see, is an entity of itself, apart from the individual members of the team.
Mm-hmm.
You were asked to produce these records, not the team, right?
Correct.
Okay, that's what I want to understand.
So, it's not within this same statute, but within 432B, and we cited this in our briefs, because the coroner is a member of the team, it's essentially the same thing.
But the team wasn't asked to produce. And the coroner was.
Right, but it's one and the same. I mean, we're all members of the same CDR team.
Okay.
And so, to say that the team has a privilege but the individuals don't would kind of be a strange reading of the statute, because then what privilege would there be,
So, Mr. Eccles, not every child death goes to the CDR, isn't that correct?
Correct.
So originally, you whittled it down to 126 cases, and you were prepared to do a review of those to see if there were redactions that could be made to help you produce those. Is that correct?
The 49 remaining of the 126, correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And your position, though, then, is the CDR then insulates you from that review?
Of the 77, correct. As to the 49, no, because they're non-CDR cases.
Okay.
How do you square your position with NRS 432B.175, which seems to specifically call for the records of the when a child dies or nearly dies as a result of abuse or neglect, specifically calling for that to be public record?
The way I square that, Your Honor, is in NRS 239.010. 432B.407 is specifically mentioned as an exception to public records.
Right.
So, look, this is just how I think about it, and maybe that's just me, but like when you have attorney-client privilege, right?
Mm-hmm.
So your communications with your attorney are privileged. But if you have a document that's not privileged, you can't give it to your attorney and say, now it's privileged, right? If the coroner has an autopsy report, you can't give it to the CDR team and say, oh, now it's privileged.
Well, I think based on sub 6, it would be privileged because it talks about the documents acquired by, and then there's a presumptive 30-year period. It does.
So does the coroner keep a copy in its files?
Of all the autopsies?
Yeah.
So we had to go back and look at our files because they asked for a little over 5 years, but somewhere within the coroner files, these are all kept.
Right. They don't, like, give the only copy of it over to the CDR.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, and the autopsy would be performed independent of whether or not that child's death is the subject of the CDR, of the autopsy, right?
So if a child's autopsy is taken, it depends on whether it becomes a CDR case or not.
When does that occur, before or after the autopsy?
I think it can be either one, Your Honor.
Okay, so the autopsy is independent of the CDR, although the CDR acquires a copy of the autopsy. Is that fair?
It depends, but it looks like from sub 1 of the 0.407, any autopsy coroner's investigative reports relating to the death. And one thing I've learned working with the coroner, sometimes autopsies take a long time. And we see them on TV, and you know, they're done. But sometimes they take 6 months, 9 months, over a year. Sometimes we're involved in the criminal aspect, the death penalty cases. And they can go on for a long time. And so I don't think there's a definitive answer, Your Honor, about when they always happen. I think sometimes it depends on how complicated it is. And even in the child death cases and criminal cases that we've handled, we're talking to district judges a year after the death, and we're still working on it sometimes. I will reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Then I think, Ms. McCush, I think they're still in their opening argument time, and we'll get you shortly.
May it please the court. Thank you, Jackie Nichols, for the record. The district court's award of fees and cost was in error because the district court ignored NRS 239.012. But before I get to that point, I want to make it clear that should this court reverse the district court's order on the substance of the public records request, then the award would need to be vacated because under NRS 239.011, the fee provision, the review journal has to prevail as a predicate to being awarded its fees and costs. So it's our position that should this court reverse the district court's order on the substance of the public records request, then it would automatically have to vacate the award of fees and costs.
Wasn't the court correct to find that damages and fees and attorney's fees are different things?
No, I would disagree with that. And the reason for that is, one, I would say you'd have to look at the plain language of NRS 239.012. I think what the district court did is focus on NRS 239.011. And when you look at the plain language of the immunity provision under 0.012, there's just no other interpretation that you can reach other than that damages includes attorney's fees and costs. And I'll explain that. Essentially, what the immunity provision provides is that a public officer or an official, an employee, who acts in good faith in refusing to disclose information to a requester, then the government entity is immune from damages. So the question that I have posed to the lower court and to the review journal is, in what instance would a government entity be liable for damages in refusing to disclose information under the Public Records Act? Now, if you go to NRS 239.011, which allows then the mechanism to seek judicial relief, it's limited to access to the public records. And I'd like to point out recently in a federal case in 2017, a magistrate refused to accept supplemental jurisdiction over a public records case because it recognized under 239.011 there was no claim for relief. There was no separate award for damages, which means when you go back to NRS 239.012, the only type of damages that a requester would be entitled to get from a government entity in a public records case would be attorney's fees and costs. And even if you don't interpret NRS 239.012, the term damages, to include attorney's fees and costs, at a minimum, this court has to find an ambiguity and rely on legislative history because there's clearly at least two different interpretations, right? Damages does include attorney's fees and costs, or it doesn't include attorney's fees and costs. And so when you get to the legislative history, because it's susceptible to two different interpretations, I think the legislative history is clear that damages under the Public Records Act includes attorney's fees and costs. And specifically, if you look at AB 365 in 1993, what that bill did was codify the immunity provision and the fee provision at the same time. But prior to that, the MPRA did not provide a mechanism for the requester to get access to records. It only provided for a criminal penalty. And so what the LCB did, as far as making recommendations to the legislature, said, hey, pull back that criminal penalty. Let's create a mechanism to allow requesters to get access to records. But while we do this, they can also get their attorney's fees and costs. But we also need to recognize that government entities and their employees needed to be shielded from liability in certain instances. And that standard is a good faith standard, which is also recognized in other statutes when you're talking about government entities, such as NRS 41.032.
Why wouldn't that be in 011, though, if that was a legislative intent? Say you could get a prevailing party and get attorney's fees and costs unless the provider acted in good faith in withholding them.
Sure. Well, what I think happened is when the legislature passed it, they passed it together. So it was a Section 2 and a Section 3, and they just codified it in two separate statutes. That's all. And under the rules of statutory construction, we are required to, when you're talking about multiple provisions within a statutory scheme, construe them together. And so while I understand that maybe the immunity provision isn't a subsection under 0.011, that does not mean that it does not apply to attorney's fees and costs. It's just a separate statute.
Well, either we can construe them in harmony, or they're ambiguous when we're looking at legislative intent. So which is it?
Well, I think our first argument, Your Honor, is under the plain language that it's clear. However, it is ambiguous to the extent that damages can be construed as attorney's fees, to include attorney's fees and costs, or not to include attorney's fees and costs. And then when you get to the legislative history, between the LCB outlining the recommendations for the legislature actually taking that action and adopting those recommendations, and then when you get to the committee hearings, and every single time you're talking about attorney's fees and costs in relation to accessing public records requests, the immunity provision and the good faith standard are discussed. So, after determining that the good faith standard does apply in this case, the next step is to determine whether or not the coroner acted in good faith. The reasons outlined for the coroner not acting in good faith are twofold. One, because it relied on the Attorney General provision, and then two, that it didn't comply with the MPRA. As far as the Attorney General opinion is concerned, that's the entire purpose of Attorney General opinions, is to guide public agencies. So I understand, and the coroner concedes, that an Attorney General opinion is not binding precedent, but that does not mean that it cannot rely on the legal underpinnings which were cited in the Attorney General opinion. As far as not complying with the MPRA, the coroner here responded within the 5-day timeline, met with the Review Journal reporters on a Sunday, provided additional spreadsheets, in and prior to litigation, offered to provide the Review Journal with redacted autopsy reports of the non-49 CDR autopsies.
Ms. Nichols, an Attorney General opinion cannot make something confidential that isn't confidential, correct?
I'm sorry?
The Attorney General opinion, which I understand was offered back by then Attorney General Bryan, but what the statute talks about is providing citation to the specific statute or other legal authority that makes the public book or record or report thereof confidential. So my question is, how can an Attorney General opinion make a public book or record confidential?
So the answer to that, Your Honor, is the Daubert balancing test. So under Daubert, there is that balancing test where it has to balance between the interest of non-disclosure versus the interest of public access. And so that's the balancing test authority that's relied on, and then the legal underpinnings of the Attorney General opinion help support the reasons why the autopsy reports are confidential.
So is it some evidence of public policy under that balancing? Is that what
yes,
you're saying?
Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. You have almost 11 minutes. I like that. Ms. McClatchy, now.
And Ms. McClatchy, before you get started, just before you sit, please address the 50-cent extraordinary fee issue.
Absolutely.
You might know, probably weren't going to start with that, but I'm going to ask Mr. Eccles about it, and I just want to make sure you address it.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Maggie McClatchy for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I have Review-Journal investigative reporter Art Kane here with me today, as well as other representatives from the Review-Journal. Even the coroner's office, at some stages of this proceeding in the public records request, has agreed autopsy records are public records. Providing them to the public significantly advances the public interest. In this case, the interest advanced is preventing child deaths, and both by accountability of the coroner's office, but also of the foster care system. This kind of accountability is exactly what the Public Records Act was designed to advance. A prevailing requester is also entitled to the reasonable costs and fees. The only limitation on the entitlement, it says entitled in the statute, is reasonable. The NPRA's fees and costs provision is clear, and reading a restriction into it would render the NPRA a toothless tiger. It would be very hard for the average requester to go to court to enforce the Public Records Act, and even for those requesters who were able to hire an attorney to go to court, it would make it unnecessarily complicated and expensive. Further, the coroner's argument that fees and costs aren't recoverable in the absence of bad faith or if there's good faith would actually entirely swallow the Public Records Act, because the immunity provision provides not just immunity from damages, but also for immunity from suit. So if their interpretation is to be agreed with, then what we would have to do is say you couldn't go to court, and an automatic defense, almost like in an anti-SLAPP case, would be good faith, because what it says is immunity from suit and damages. The coroner's arguments to the contrary and gymnastics of statutory construction are all at odds with the mandates of the NPRA. The NPRA itself tells this court how its terms should be interpreted. This court, in the Reno Newspapers v. Sheriff Haley case, rejected statutory arguments just like those made by the coroner's office that are made in isolation from the NPRA's mandates. In that case, the court said, they fail in light of the explicit rules of construction stated in NRS 239.001, which says that open records are the rule and that exceptions to the rule are narrowly constructed. Ambiguity needs to be resolved in favor of access. We cited, I think it's the McKay case, an open meeting law case that says even if there is ambiguity here, that ambiguity needs to be resolved in light of the underlying policy of the open meeting law. Here, the Public Records Act, which is obviously a lot like the open meeting law, if there is any ambiguity, has to be resolved in favor of the underlying purpose, which is stated expressly in the NPRA. The coroner never explains how his arguments comport with the dictates of statutory construction contained in the Public Records Act.
How would you distinguish this? You know, the coroner brought up, I think, in supplemental authorities, the City of Henderson order that came out of this court. How do you distinguish it, what happened in City of Henderson, and are concluding that they were within the 5 business days from this case?
Well, even without the arguments regarding waiver, the district court did consider all of the district court did find that they waived. But the district court also went on to continue here to address all of the arguments that they made. And while they make a vague argument that the district court didn't address the underpinnings of the attorney general opinion, the district court at the transcript explicitly said it was addressing all of their arguments. Here, this court should hold that there's no blanket rule that either autopsy reports or that specifically juvenile autopsy reports are secret. And that's because what this court's case law and the text of the NPRA dictate is that in order for there to be a blanket carve-out from the NPRA for a category of records, like autopsy records, the legislative intent to do so needs to be expressed and unequivocal. And the coroner's arguments that, for example, the CDR team statute is expressed and unequivocal is anything but. And by the way, their interpretation would also mean that any autopsy they review could never be introduced in a murder case or in a civil case. And so their interpretation has very bizarre and extreme consequences.
Assuming we agreed with you, Ms. McClatchy, do you acknowledge that other statutes relating to confidentiality of medical records, both federal and state, would form the basis for redaction of autopsy reports?
I'm of the position that these are not medical records, and a number of courts have held consistent with that, that because a person is deceased, the coroner is not a provider of health care. And so I don't think that these are medical records. There's even a case, I forget which state this was from, but even when you can't assert that here our coroner is not a medical doctor, but even when it's a medical doctor that's being requested of the records, that the physician-patient privilege, for example, does not apply.
The issue of redaction and whether redaction for medical purposes, I don't think is really covered by this appeal, is it?
The issue of redactions is not provided right. Skill. They never produced an index. We did not want the records redacted because information filtered through the coroner's office is not the kind of information that advances the significant public interest that access to autopsy reports provide for. In this case, the significant policy interest is preventing child deaths and assessing how well the foster care system is doing. And in one instance, the coroner wanted to redact records. In another instance, they wanted to create a chart with some minimal information. And in order to fully assess autopsy reports, we need the full picture. In the case of autopsy reports of kids, they very well may not have next of kin to protect their interests. The next of kin rights of privacy would certainly not outweigh the interest in the favor in light of the interest in accountability, in particular because they may be implicated in whatever caused the harm. The child death review statute is relevant, I think, to one thing, and that it does recognize the important policy issue underlying not secrecy, but the importance of looking at child deaths, and in particular deaths of kids that are vulnerable.
I'd like to follow up on Justice Hardesty's point, though. The physician-patient privilege does not expire with the death of the patient, correct?
HIPAA records, I think the Department of Justice has said that it does expire. I would be happy to further brief that. But I think in this instance, the issue is that when you're performing the function of the coroner, we're not seeking the medical records of the coroner.
Right, it's a simple question. The doctor-patient privilege survives the death of the patient, correct or not correct?
I don't know that that's correct. I think that in the HIPAA context, that's not correct.
So you think that you lose your physician-patient privilege upon death?
I do think that could be the case. That I'd be happy to submit further briefing, but I think of relevance to this case, there is no physician-patient relationship because the
coroner... Oh, I understand that, okay. But the coroner needs to look at medical records in some cases. I would certainly, his affidavit alludes to that, and it stands to reason he would if he's assessing, you know, a true deep background on what led to this person's death, child or adult.
Understood, but we're not seeking the medical records that the coroner looked at. We're looking at the autopsy records themselves.
What about to the extent the autopsy report refers to medical records that the coroner obtained?
I would take the position that they are still public records, and I would also take the position that in this case, let's assume the balancing test applies. Let's assume the privacy balancing test applies to this case, Your Honor. If that's the case, the coroner had to come forward with more than just sort of general hypothetical concerns that were issued, for example, in the firearms permit case, saying, "Hey, if you produce this information, it could cause embarrassment or could cause danger." The coroner has said some of these reports could contain medical information that we got from doctors, and they never came forward to even make that threshold showing. And I don't think the court now should remand for further proceedings in light of CCSD, because while the CCSD case did change the framework of how this court balances tests, does the balancing test, once a privacy interest is asserted, it can't have, or it would have been wrongly decided, and it didn't change NRS 239.0113, that always required the coroner to come forward, the government entity, to come forward with evidence. In this case, in deciding the CCSD case, made clear that it was not changing the holdings in Gibbons, and obviously this court couldn't change the fact that NRS 239.0113 says that they need to come forward with a preponderance of the evidence to establish a claim of confidentiality. So with regard to privacy, they should have come forward with more evidence. They didn't. I don't think remanding at this stage is appropriate.
This is a different subject, but it's also statutory, as a lot of this is. AB 57 gave me pause because
your colleague across the aisle is arguing, why would you need statutory authorization for the coroner to give autopsy reports to certain people if anyone could walk in and make a public records request of the coroner for those autopsy reports? And he's sort of citing the Ramsey case that implicit in the express authorization and the expansion of that is a recognition, perhaps articulated in the AGO, perhaps common law, perhaps the collection of statutes they're citing, that says these are generally not public records.
I think the issue is they're relying on general statutory construction rules. In this case, what this court has said is that a carve-out from the NPRA has to be express and unequivocal, and what they're arguing...
No, I think they're making a different argument. I think they're arguing that the statutory provision that widened the category of people to whom the coroner could provide autopsy reports recognizes legislatively and endorses the common law recognition that in general, as expressed in the AGO, autopsy reports are not available to anyone who comes in and asks for them. Now, I don't weigh in on that, but that's their argument. I think it's a little different from what you just said.
So when you look at the legislative history of AB 57, though, yeah, there was no discussion about making these records confidential. Instead, the
Why would we need that statute if...
They were trying to expand who would get next of kin notifications, and it says the coroner may provide, may notify additional people, and as a sort of secondary item, it does say that they can provide, may provide copies of the office.
But if they were already subject to public records, they wouldn't need that authorization, would they?
Well, I don't think it was their intent to create confidentiality by making clear that the coroner can go and tell additional people besides the people they used to be able to tell, give the immediate notification of death. To say that at the same time you can provide an autopsy report, in my view, is not the same thing as saying otherwise they're all confidential. And I think that arguing that this implies that it must be the existing state of law, I think that's exactly the kind of argument by implication that this court has rejected when saying that the declaration of confidentiality and a carve-out from the NPRA does need to be expressed and unequivocal. I want to address the redactions and cost issue before I run out too much.
Before you do that.
Sure.
My understanding of Mr. Eccles's argument is that under 432B, 1AD, the statute allows for these records to become confidential when they are transferred to the CDR team. I'd like you to address his argument that at least those autopsies, which have been conveyed to the CDR team, then became confidential and not subject to disclosure.
Following Justice Pickering's question in our conversation, if it were true that we're already existing state of law that autopsy records were secret, by the way, we also wouldn't have ever needed the CDR, very specific and limited confidentiality provision. It's my view that this statute only deals with materials that are held by the CDR team. So while the CDR team's work is secret, that does not mean that documents sent to them, just like documents sent to your attorney, don't automatically, magically become confidential in all their iterations.
Well, the words are pretty clear, if I'm reading this correctly. Any autopsy and coroner's investigative records. The word autopsy is in the statute, and it is rendered confidential.
It is rendered confidential in the hands of the child death review team. We sought records and are suing the coroner's office, not Mr. Fudenberg as a representative of the CDR team. I think that's an important distinction. And I think, too, reading this CDR team statute this way would have bizarre and unintended consequences, because if you look at 432B.4076, it says information acquired by and the records of a multidisciplinary team to review the death of a child are confidential, must not be disclosed, and are not subject to subpoena, discovery, or introduction into evidence into any civil or criminal proceeding. So they don't explain how this would mean that autopsy records of kids at the CDR, kids' deaths that the CDR team looks at, could ever get into a criminal trial. So I think that this supports our interpretation that we cannot make a public records act to the CDR team. We can't try to figure out which cases the CDR team is looking at. We cannot do that. But that does not mean that the autopsy records are confidential. In fact, the history of this case shows that why the statute doesn't apply. At the very beginning, before the coroner knew the intent of the reporter, the coroner didn't assert this privilege. It was only after they learned that Mr. Kane was investigating issues with the foster care system and deaths of kids in the foster care system that they said, wait, you're looking at deaths that might also have been looked at by the CDR team, so now we're going to assert this new claim. That, to me, supports the position that that privilege just does not apply.
Ms. McClatchy, isn't the CDR team's request so that the CDR team can get unredacted, like the full picture of things sometimes that may not be subject to public records or may be subject to redaction? CDR team gets it straight from whatever agency they request it from with the proviso that that information to them will be protected. So somebody can't circumvent by going to the CDR team to get from the CDR team perhaps what they couldn't get from another agency. I'm not saying this particular, not, I'm not talking about autopsies in particular, but this is to help the CDR team do its job, not to help keep the public out of these other areas. Is that correct?
I think it's to maintain the confidentiality of the CDR team's right. work, which is why I think it's so important that the public be able to have access to these autopsy reports, regardless of whether the CDR team is also looking at, because the public itself, and this is what the Public Records Act is designed to do, the public itself is allowed to assess, for example, are there too many kids in foster care system that are dying? In fact, recently, it's my understanding the county commission Commissioner Segerblum wanted to look at child deaths and was told that he couldn't have access to this. So the idea that autopsy records and some privacy concerns or other arguments about autopsy records should trump access, I think just doesn't fly. There are significant reasons, not just in this case, but across the board. Sometimes coroners make mistakes. Access to autopsy reports has helped vindicate the wrongfully convicted. It's helped correct errors when the coroner's office has made errors. Coroners are not perfect. While it's controversial, the coroner's office does have a very important function. And having a rule that says we can't get access to autopsy reports with poor consumer protection.
Well, it's not just autopsy reports. It's autopsy reports that have been given to the CDR team. What concerns me is the language that's used in this statute. And I struggle with way this statute is written. I don't think there's anything that prohibits the legislature to say that we're going to take autopsy reports that this court might consider to be public records and now render them confidential because of their subsequent use. And that seems to be what this statute is doing. I think your interpretation of the statute may render the statute absurd, because that would seem to suggest that other records that are referenced in the statute, any medical or mental records of the child, any records of social or rehabilitative services, I think the intent is to include all of those records as confidential once they are conveyed to the CDR team.
In the possession of the CDR team, but these records are already otherwise, may already otherwise be confidential. And my point isn't that this creates a public record. My point is that the presumption is that something is a public record.
I'm operating from the assumption that the autopsy reports, adult and juvenile, are public records. The argument that I understand is a follow-up to Justice Kadish's question earlier. Do these records become confidential when they are transmitted to the CDR team by the coroner?
And my answer to that question is the CDR team's possession of those records is confidential. The cases the CDR team is looking at is confidential. And nothing becomes unconfidential because the CDR team is looking at it. However, if a document is a public record, when you're seeking it from someone other than the CDR team, just like in the Burns case, that records are stored in one place or held by a different entity or person, they don't become confidential in all iterations and all sources. The CDR team's work is confidential. I have not sought records from the CDR team. I have not sought the underlying medical records. What I'm saying is that just because the CDR team was also looking at the autopsy reports that my client was looking at or wanted to look at, doesn't make it confidential. In fact, again, the coroner didn't even assert this claim until he figured out the purpose of the reporter's investigation, which I think is problematic. And I want to address both fees and costs and the redactions issue before I run out of time. With redactions, to some degree, the coroner's argument about extraordinary use, in my opinion, is rendered moot because the legislature in SB 287, due to, I think, a lot of the confusion in cases like this, it got rid of SB 280. It got rid of extraordinary use. That's no longer in the statute. But it's my position that especially when redactions are contested, like in a case like this, it's inappropriate to make the requester pay for the cost of redacting. I also don't think that the NPRA ever allows the government to incur a cost it incurs anyway, and that's in the definitions of actual costs.
Ms. McClatchy, you're short of the appropriateness of it. Do you think there was a legislative intent to cap that at 50 cents? Whether it's appropriate or not, is there a hard cap in your view based on the statute?
In my view, the plain text does support a hard cap at 50 cents. It absolutely does. And they still have to be reasonable, and they still have to be actually incurred. And then the statute goes on to define actually incurred as something they wouldn't have incurred anyway.
Is the statute ambiguous?
I don't think the statute is ambiguous because I think it makes clear that it's capped at 50 cents. But I think it's great the legislature got rid of it because I think it's much more appropriate to limit government entities only to recoup actual costs that they wouldn't have incurred anyway. And that's what SB 287 does now.
Well, but that's not effective till October 1, so I don't think it applies to this case, do you?
Well, I think clarification might apply retroactively, and the issue is when are these redactions being made? They've actually argued for a point about the next of kin statute. They're trying to apply that retroactively.
Well, we haven't briefed clarification here. I know this issue came up on supplemental briefing or notification to the court, but we really haven't briefed clarification and the purpose behind SB 287.
And I'm sure both sides would be happy to do that, Your Honor.
Yeah, I had a slightly different question. I wondered, but maybe you've answered it for me, whether because of SB 287, at least the case being argued by Ms. Nichols warrants an opinion or an order. It would seem like the issues now are different as a result of SB 287, which would seem to focus on an order rather than an opinion.
Well, with cost, SB 287, in my view, I'm sorry, with regard to fees, what SB 287 says in the preamble is that it's designed to clarify existing law regarding the entitlement to fees and costs. And I think it's important when we're looking at the fees and costs provision. While Ms. Nichols argues that they were together and next to each other in the legislative history, their construction is actually very, very different. While there's a provision that provides that says you can get access to the records by suing a government entity and going to court, and if you do that, you're the prevailing requester, you're entitled to your reasonable fees and costs, period. The only limitation is reasonable. The separate immunity provision deals with immunity of employees and officials and his or her employer, sort of like in a vicarious liability kind of situation. And in contrast, the damages you get from the government entity that you sue to get access.
But it certainly would seem like the exchange between Senator Segerbloom and Senator Kiekerfer on the floor of the legislature in April of 2013 warrants some clarification. It looks like they asked whether the hard cap applied or not, and the tender of the bill, Senator Segerbloom says, Well, not really, in effect. So it certainly warrants some clarification.
Well, I think the discussion back and forth between legislators is unclear at best, and I go back to the language of the statute, and I go back to the legislature's mandates that all of the provisions, which to me includes both the prior extraordinary use provision and the fees and costs provision, all those provisions are supposed to be interpreted in favor of access. Their interpretation of the immunity provision could actually make it impossible for people to ever go to court because, again, it's immunity from suit as well as from damages. And the other issue, too, is that even if we read it more narrowly, it's only immunity from damages.
Do you think there's a claim against the government for damages independent of attorney's fees and costs for refusal to produce public records?
I do. And by the way, the immunity provision is immunity from not providing and from providing. And we did read a number of examples from other jurisdictions, like a Hawaii case where I think a reporter provided inaccurate information about a deed and they got sued in negligence for providing that information. And there, a very similar immunity provision was brought forward. They point out that if we sue for a federal civil rights violation, the state immunity provision probably wouldn't apply. I appreciate them taking that position, but we could sue under state constitutional claims, and they could certainly try to assert the claim that we can't get damages or even sue because of this immunity provision. There certainly have been cases. We did brief them, and I can certainly imagine cases. For example, I do think I could sue the government for giving, if they gave the Las Vegas Sun articles access to information, they didn't give the Review Journal access to it. It's very possible to imagine torts and other claims against government entities for not providing access. Besides, what the provision does earlier is just say, hey, this is how you go to court to get access. The separate provision deals with damages. The other provision doesn't deal with damages at all. It just says, hey, you go to court, and then if you win, you get your fees and costs. By the way, just as a housekeeping matter, I think there was some confusion, and we apologize for not making it clear in our opposition, but the NRS that we cited, that they said no longer provides for fees expressly as an element of damages, that statute has been amended since the Albios case was decided, and so we apologize for any confusion about that. But our point was that where the legislature has deemed that to indicate that attorney's fees and costs are an element of damages rather than a separate statutory avenue, they did see fit. They later amended the statute, but back in Albios was decided that provision did separately provide for fees and costs. I also just want to point out that if this court were to rule that the attorney fees and cost provision required us to establish lack of good faith, or they could assert good faith as an affirmative defense, it's not quite clear. There would be a lot of unintended consequences. And not only could the average requester, the Review Journal, not as frequently, but perhaps could still bring a public records case, but the average requester, the average citizen, would have a very hard time finding an attorney, especially because these cases are hard to litigate. It's expensive and difficult to litigate against the government. The government has taken the position that we're not entitled to discovery in public records cases. So how on earth, if we're not entitled to discoveries, is their position, how can we establish their intent? Further, when we sue for public records, I didn't sue Mr. Fugenberg. I sued the coroner's office. And would I also have to sue him in order to get him into the case, but I make him a party and try to bring claims against him for bad faith, failure to disclose? It would make these cases unnecessarily complicated and expensive, not just for requesters, but also for the taxpayers that are footing the bill for the government attorneys.
Well, if we were to assume that, assuming that we find that damages is the same as for purposes of fees, why wouldn't this record show here that the county acted in good faith? They followed Attorney General's decision. They met with the Review Journal trying to clarify what records were needed on a Sunday. Why couldn't we find good faith based on this record?
Well, first of all, it's unclear. Good faith doesn't just mean being nice or cooperative. as the Public Records Act as amended now provides. It's unclear what good faith would even mean. But here, I don't think that the coroner's office did act in good faith.
But they were they listened to the district attorney who gave them advice. They followed the attorney general. Why couldn't, because I saw that you had mentioned that this court should not remand if we go along with the county to make a determination. Why doesn't this record show good faith?
If this record shows good faith because they relied on advice from counsel, then in every single public records case they would say we relied on advice of counsel, and I would have to consider suing the attorneys from the civil division from the DA's office for their bad faith response, which in my view relied on an inapplicable AGO that was predicated on a way earlier iteration of the Public Records Act before the burdens were strengthened in favor of requesters. And so then I think this raises exactly the kinds of problems we would have in this litigation. I would have to sue Ms. Rabe. Perhaps the attorneys who aren't here about coughing would have to be sued. It would make these cases unnecessarily complicated and expensive, but I don't think their legal arguments in this case were made in good faith, and some of them weren't made until they even knew why we wanted records, which in my view violates the First Amendment as well.
Thank you very much, Ms. McClatchy. Mr. Eccles, you have rounded off at an even 11. I think Ms. McClatchy went over a few seconds. Here's the woman. There we go. Okay, Mr. Eccles, you may proceed. Did you want to divide your rebuttal time with Ms. Nichols, too?
I do. I'll leave for about 5 or 6 minutes.
Okay, very well.
So we agree with counsel's statement for the RJ that the Public Records Act is indeed robust. Calls for transparency. That's what all the case law from this court states. But we have the exception, NRS 239.010, which I mentioned in my opening argument. Bless you, Your Honor. 432B.407, not just sub 6, but the entire statute is exempt from the public records.
Mr. Eccles, if the CDR, as part of its review, gathers newspaper articles about the offense where people made statements about the offense, and they gather them as part of their review, are those confidential?
That's a good question, Your Honor. If we go by the strict language of...
Would you argue they were confidential? Suddenly, have those newspaper articles been transformed into a confidential document?
If I had to just guess, I'd probably say no.
But the CDR has used them and has them in their bucket now. So how would we apply that to newspaper articles differently than we would apply it to the autopsy in this context?
And I think because sub 1 of the CDR statute lists what are the materials the CDR team is going to be gathering. Now, if the CDR team looks at other materials outside of what's in sub 1, then I think that's just not affected by the statute. I wanted to try to answer a few questions that came up during the answering argument, if I can. One of the questions was about the confidentiality. So I did mention 239.0115 that has the 30-year period. Documents that are presumed confidential or are confidential by the CDR statute, it's not in the perpetuity. The Public Records Act says that it ends at 30 years. And then if the government entity wanted to go beyond 30 years, then we have to show some reason beyond that. In federal law, we've cited HIPAA, and the corresponding CFR is 45 CFR 164.502 sub F through G, which is cited in our opening brief, that says under HIPAA, they're confidential for 50 years. And so by virtue of us looking at somebody's medical records in order to perform an autopsy, those records don't automatically become non-confidential.
The records they're seeking, if I understand it, are the autopsy reports themselves, not other medical records that may have been gathered. Is that your understanding as well?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
There are medical records and what those records say within especially child autopsy, especially when you have battered children.
And
that have prior instances of being abused.
That's true, Your Honor. Sometimes autopsy reports will have medical records appended or referred to in the autopsy reports. And that's what the CDR statute calls for here. Let me see if I can address the 239.055 issue. This is the extraordinary use of personnel. In this case, it doesn't present a great divide on the 50 cents per page versus the amount we were going to charge. We looked at the non-CDR cases. So there were 77 CDR cases, 49 non-CDR cases. And we gave a sample of this is what a redacted non-CDR autopsy report would look like. And we said, we're not going to charge you for this one. We just wanted to show you a sample. And we estimated 10 to 12 hours for the 49 reports at a combined rate of $45 an hour for an attorney and non-attorney staff within the civil division at Clark County. And so if you looked at the 49 non-CDR reports, it might, and we charge 50 cents per page for reviewing and redacting, it might actually be more than our hourly rate, which I think would be about between $450 to $500. And so this isn't a great case to make the distinctions in 239.05 because it kind of reaches the same result. But we do agree with our position in the briefs that 50 cents is just the per page, which is standard in a lot of statutes for producing records, medical records, for example, at medical facilities. Any other questions that the court has for me?
Can I just clarify the chart that I understand was provided in response to the request? That includes the names of these decedent children, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
It's got their names, their date of death, does it, and the cause and manner of death as well?
Correct, Your Honor.
As determined by the coroner?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And that's pursuant to...
Because, look, just not being deeply involved in this until preparing for today's hearing, I would think, you know, well, something that you might want to redact out of a report is the child's name, but that's something that has already been given.
And that's pursuant to Clark County Code.
Yeah.
And usually that's not released until after... next of kin, usually, is notified. There are no other questions. I'll turn
I have a question. Mr.
Oh,
Eccles,
yes,
doesn't the 50, doesn't 0551 contemplate a fee not to exceed 50 cents per page for extraordinary use?
I think it can definitely be read that way.
Isn't that what it says?
And I think the statute's ambiguous because it's talking about two different things. The copy and the extraordinary use of personnel. And really what we're doing, what we're receiving on these public records cases, Your Honor, stacks and stacks of public records, people who are essentially employed to respond to public records. And if we only are limited to 50 cents per page, it's essentially somebody who's just doing this nonstop.
But, I mean, the statute doesn't seem ambiguous. If a request for copy requires a governmental entity to make extraordinary use of its personnel, so that's obviously your personnel, you may, in addition to any other fee authorized, charge a fee not to exceed 50 cents for such extraordinary use. And then the second statute talks about reasonable, has to be reasonable and actual.
Mm-hmm.
Can't we read those in harmony and say, well, it means you can't charge 50 cents for extraordinary use if the actual extraordinary use fee was 25 cents? I mean, why can't we read these together and say the legislature intended a hard cap on that?
Mm-hmm.
And so you still got to show it's reasonable and actual, but that 50 cents is your ceiling.
Well, I think because we're talking about two different things, Your Honor, and that comes out, that's very clear from the legislative history, the fee and the extraordinary use.
Why am I looking at the legislative history? This is, why isn't this clear? What it said, I'm just reading, I just read what it said to you.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't I just read it as it's written?
And so in this particular case,
mm-hmm.
if they want to give us 50 cents per page, we'll take it. It'll be more than our fee.
If it were reasonable and actually not to exceed the actual cost either. So.
And I think $45 an hour for an attorney and a non-attorney staff combined hourly rate, I think they'd have a hard time saying that's not reasonable.
Well, that would be their argument to make. The question is whether or not that's a 50 cent hard top, and then you have to show reasonable and actual.
Right.
Is that, should I interpret that differently?
I just go back to my same argument, Your Honor. The copy and the extraordinary use, and the wording here, I don't like the wording. It could have been clearer, but I don't think there's only one interpretation. I think we have at least two interpretations here on that statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Before you sit down, could you describe generically what is the redacted information on the autopsy report that you gave as an example?
I didn't do that particular redaction. That was done in-house before we got involved.
Okay, but categorically, what is sought to be protected by the redactions?
So I've seen some unredacted autopsy reports before, and so I can just go off of that, Your Honor. You're talking about evidence of sexual orientation, diseases, tattoos, and in some examples, you know, we don't know what this person's family knows. We gave some examples in our opening brief as well, going through some of these things.
What about like a pre-existing medical condition that was non-contributory, was determined by the coroner to be non-contributory to the death? That may have been some sort of genetic anomaly that he has brothers and sisters. I mean, I'm just trying to...
And that's true, too. I mean, there are all these possibilities. We have things like, you know, if it was a female, was she pregnant, for example? Maybe the family, or beyond the family, she doesn't want that knowing.
Okay, but we don't have a definite definition of where you would draw the line on redaction here. That this record doesn't tell us that.
Basically, what we did on redaction is we just gave the basic areas we would normally disclose to the public.
So the same as in the chart that you engaged with Justice Kedishon?
And I think that's why if the court is going to order redaction, we need a remand for the CCSD because we have articulated more than just de minimis personal privacy in autopsy records.
Thank you, Mr. Eccles.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Can Ms. Scobert, do you want to come up? Will you have... Still running. I'm going to give you 2 minutes here because we're going to begin.
Thank you. I'd like to just address two points that were brought up by Ms. McCletchie. First of all, the immunity statute doesn't say immunity from suit. It's immunity from liability of damages. So that does not make NRS 239.011 absolutely absurd because they still can bring suit to get access to the public records, which is exactly what that provision provides. What the immunity provision says is they don't get damages if the entity acts in good faith. As far as the good faith standard is concerned, I think you need to look at the party's conduct. And here, I think the record reflects that the coroner did act in good faith. It's not just because that they relied on their attorney's advice. It's you have to look at how soon did they answer. They responded and were in constant communication with the reporters here since day one. You should also look at what effort did the agency make in trying to understand what they were requesting. Here, the coroner met with them on a Sunday, provided two different types of spreadsheets, and then even offered, in the end, prior to litigation, to provide unredacted copies. I think that meets more than the good faith standard under the immunity provision. Any questions for me?
Questions? Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Nichols. We appreciate that. Thank both counsel, as always. Excellent arguments and briefs. Very interesting issues. So we will take this case under submission and we'll be in recess.